You are listening to a sermon by J. Evan Kreider, recorded on Sunday, February 5th, 2012, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
The Song of Songs is sometimes known as the Song of Solomon, from an ambiguous attribution in verse 1, and it's a wonderfully sensual poem or song. To call it the Song of Songs is, like Saddam saying, it's the mother of all songs, sort of. And this song has been understood in radically different ways. The Jews, early on, had some rabbis who approached the Song of Songs allegorically. And they viewed it as God having love for the chosen people. And it was that point of view, we believe, that made it possible to bring the Song of Songs into Hebrew scripture, because they need some way to get it in there. Others have viewed it as a kind of sacred marriage liturgy. Something, and some scholars have gone back into Mesopotamian mythology, and they see it drawing on ideas in mythology, particularly in mythology from the goddess of fertility and her love for her brother god. We're not going to pursue that. The NRSV is the clearest of all translations. It says, we view this as a wedding song, and we want you to know that, because however you view something is going to determine how you translate the verbs and tenses. And so at least when you approach the NRSV, you know what glasses they're using as they look at the text. Still others consider it a mortuary song. This is a bizarre interpretation in which you celebrate love and almost the orgy of love, because love, even when there's death, is more strong than death, and you can love someone past death. It's a difficult way to approach it. I don't think it's that fruitful. Still others view this as a secular love poem or poetry. Very few consider it to be one poem. I've seen people consider it as many as 28 poems, sort of bunched together. But they say, if you take the secular love poetry interpretation of the Song of Songs, then what you're really saying is that this is depicting young lovers who have not yet obtained consent to marry, but they are anticipating eventually coming together. And some, particularly evangelicals, will see Solomon being in the song who, in spite of being the king, is blatantly unsuccessful in his attempts to lure a pure farm girl maiden into his harem. So I did one better than Solomon. Frankly, I don't think this is ever going to hear the airwaves. Because this pure farm girl loves someone else, not the king. She loves the shepherd, someone probably her age and in her economic bracket and whatnot. And the king cannot buy her love, he cannot coerce it, he cannot do anything to get her into the harem. The interpretations I'm going to explore this morning are different still. I've been intrigued by the interpretations as devised by the church fathers and by people in the Middle Ages. And I hope that this admittedly complicated approach will somehow be endured by you, and that it will give you just a glimpse into how medieval Christians, meaning medieval intellectual Christians, approached these verses specifically and how they approached the Bible generally. So let's begin with the first one. I'll skip verse 1, which is never sung, doesn't matter here. It says, the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's, and that can mean one of three things. It can mean that it is written by Solomon, but virtually no one agrees with that point of view. It can mean that it was written for Solomon. Very few would accept that point of view. Or it could be written about Solomon, and a few people agree with that point of view. Others simply say that was the last verse written and it was pure speculation. Let's get to the meat of things. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. Now you'll see some footnotes. Here we go. In the Middle Ages, and every time I refer to the Middle Ages, I'll simply say M.A. In the Middle Ages, I first mention Origen of Alexandria in the 3rd century. And he said there's a surface meaning, that the bride is ready and the groom delays. Now, I want to stop there, because Origen opens the doors to Christian writers. He takes the point of view, and is the first to do so, that we have to know who is speaking to whom. It's not that obvious. Everyone's agreed that verse 1 is a young woman and probably the bride, but we don't know it's the bride. But everyone after that has assumed that you have to... Oh, Henry, it's not that bad. Welcome back. Very short protest. He assumes that this is a kind of drama, a kind of play that's being acted out. And that, and so many people after that, I mean, the NIV just struggles with this point of view and tries to figure out who all is speaking. And they get a lot of voices in there. Other people get fewer. So I mention Origen because, thanks to what he did, we always wonder now who is speaking. Origen says, okay, we have the bride and the groom on the surface, but he says there's an inner meaning, and this is something that the rabbinical writers had been coming up with for centuries earlier. And Origen says, the bride is the church, and the church is speaking with one voice. And so the bride is saying to whomever, to the groom, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. Now, to go on with Origen, he says, concerning a deeper or hidden meaning for the word kiss me, that really is saying, may the words of his mouth be poured into my mouth, as when Jesus spoke to people, from his mouth came words of faith, love, and peace. And that is what the inner meaning is of let him kiss me, which is mouth to mouth. Well, words come from mouth. And so they're allegorizing, and they're looking, trying to get past a surface meaning into a deeper meaning. In the Middle Ages, Bernard of Clairvaux, a 12th century founder of the Cistercians, he got carried away with the Song of Songs. He wrote 80 sermons on the first 3 chapters and died. And then his pupil wrote another 40 sermons on the next couple chapters and died. This is my sole sermon, I assure you, on this topic. Well, Bernard of Clairvaux said, let the mouth that kisses, that is the kisser, signify the word who takes on human nature. And let the mouth that is being kissed represent the flesh that is being taken on. Good luck. But you can see how they're pushing and pressing and trying to get deeper and deeper possible understandings and inspiration, mystical kind of inspiration from it. Honorius of Autun in the 12th century, he felt that this was the daughter of Pharaoh who is being married to Solomon, and he gets this idea from 1 Kings 3 and 1 Kings 11. And so he writes, the daughter of Pharaoh who is to be married to Solomon is overcome with love and answers Solomon's messengers, look, I do not want any further greeting through you messengers. Let Solomon himself kiss me with the kiss of his mouth. And then Honorius goes on to explain. On the other hand, this pertains to the allegory that Solomon is Christ, that the daughter of Pharaoh is the church, which answers his messengers, the prophets, by saying, let him who has promised become incarnate now after all this time and kiss me with his presence and with his own mouth speak to me the peace that was once lost and is now restored. Rupert of Deutz in the 12th century, a Benedictine, looked at this as being the Virgin Mary, and many medieval writers saw the Virgin Mary in this. So much of liturgy devoted to Mary and art and music devoted to Mary uses imagery and phrases from the Song of Songs. He was reminded in this first line of the angel speaking to Mary and saying, you have found favor. And Mary replied, be it according to your word. Be it unto me. And then Rupert says, that is her saying that God has kissed her with the kiss of his mouth. And the writers go to great lengths to assure us that God is not kissing with his mouth, but with the kiss of his mouth. Go figure. But, well, let's hasten on to line two of our poem. It's not every sermon that gets into this. For your breasts are better than wine. The switch from me in line one, let him kiss me, to your in line two is initially confusing. But ever since the 4th century, it's been agreed that the bride is the one who is speaking here, and the bride is the church or the believing soul or the people of God waiting for the advent of Jesus or the Virgin Mary. But in the Middle Ages, footnote 3, Nicholas of Lyra in the 14th century wrote that these particular breasts belong to the bridegroom. I cannot tell you what a downer that was when I read that phrase. That the breasts are similar to the word, and the word is understood to be feminine, just as we heard in Proverbs, wisdom is feminine. And so in the Middle Ages, they combine very cleverly all of these feminine things and sort of pull them together. Breasts, that which is feminine, gives knowledge, wisdom, that which is feminine. Breasts give milk, and milk is useful for infants, as nourishment for infants. Now, that's self-evident. But in the Middle Ages, that was dynamite. And that was, in essence, what the Reformation was about in part. What the church fathers were really saying is, the Bible is really too hard for most people to understand. only we, the monastic university intellectuals, understand the meat of the Bible, and the rest is milk for the babes. We're familiar with that image, but we're not familiar with that kind of pejorative thinking about laity. And it certainly goes against the very essence of our approach to being church. Well, the Middle Ages is invariably going to associate breasts with the teaching of the church, usually implying elementary teaching. And Origen rephrases this particular line, and he said, look at it this way. Your heart, O bridegroom, and your mind, which is to say the teachings that are within you, or the grace of those teachings, they surpass any wine that ordinarily gladdens the heart. Or, Origen also says elsewhere, wine symbolizes the old teachings which used to make the believer glad, like the law and the prophets. Pope Gregory the First established the Schola Cantorum in Rome, a singing school, and then his idea was that he would teach young monks how to sing chant. They would all learn the same chants, the same melodies, and then they would spread throughout Europe, and all of Christendom would eventually learn to sing the same songs. And from that, we honor him by calling it Gregorian chant. Gregory the First wrote that the breasts represent the new teachings and wisdom of Christ, and they are better than wine, the Old Testament, the law, and the prophets. William of Saint-Thierry, the 12th century Benedictine, rephrases it, as soon as I came to you, she says, you bared for me your sweet breasts, the primary nourishment that your grace affords. And because of the sweetness of your delights, knowledge and whatnot, they are better than any wine of worldly wisdom or joy of fleshly pleasure. A verse line reads, and that is why young maidens have loved you. And many writers in the Middle Ages think of the maidens as being the nations of the world, of which, they hasten to add, Israel, Judah, would be the most favored of all. Frankly, that's enough of that. What do we do with this? I had some bizarre readings this morning for you. I selected Proverbs because of it referring to wisdom, and Proverbs give us one kind of biblical literature that has been invaluable to us, although we don't pay much attention to it. I selected a passage from Mark which refers to parables, because in parables, Jesus says there's a surface meaning, and then you go beyond that to a deeper meaning. But you notice how much trouble he has. I probably chose the wrong passage. Often in a parable, in one of the writers, it will say, the kingdom of heaven is like, and then tell a story. And we almost need that clue, because to say, you know, there's a mustard seed. It's a really small seed, and it grows big. Get it? You need something to say why that's... A woman went sweeping. She couldn't find a coin. And she found it! Okay, and so in the Bible, then they say, the kingdom of heaven is like this. And then we project onto this story, okay, this opens it up. I see what's going on. Now, in the Middle Ages, they said, the three hardest passages to understand are the first chapter of Genesis, the first chapter of Ezekiel, and believe me, I'm never preaching on that. You heard why this morning. And the Song of Songs. Those are the three toughest ones to get. They're in the Bible. What in the world do we do with them? I'm just going to restrict my observations to the Song of Songs. I'm going to take another interpretation. Love is a gift from God. We all sing that God is love. I'm talking about physical love, sexual love, intercourse, intimacy, doing it. That's a gift from God. It's something that we celebrate as families. We're all here because of intercourse. This better not go on the air. Because they may not know that. And we as a church celebrate when people get together and are going to be intimate. We'll share a cake and gather around and wish them well and sign a card. We celebrate. And yet we don't talk about it in church, except most ambiguously. In some ways, the Song of Songs is an erotic poem that says, look, it's okay to talk about it. It's fine. And it's the kind of thing we need to remember because we're from the West. We've gone through Victorian schools of thought. We have, in a sense, been influenced by Catholicism, which says priests should not marry. If you really love the Lord, you give up sex. You give up physical attraction. You marry Christ. It's not part of our thinking, and yet it's in our baggage back there somehow. And I find the Song of Songs saying, no, physical love is a gift from God and it is so wonderful. It celebrates also the triumph of true love. The king with all his money, status, power, and wiles cannot get the pure farm girl to come into his bed because she is going to be faithful to the one her heart loves. And it can't get more beautiful than that. The Song of Songs celebrate lovers coming together or thinking about coming together. It really articulates the anguish of young lovers being apart. I say young lovers because I don't really know what it's like to be apart from Janice anymore, except maybe when I golf. So it's not intolerable. It dwells on the anguish of, you know, I'm not with the person I love. And that's a very real experience for the human being. It celebrates the ecstasy of intimacy. Because love is a gift of God. So we can approach the Song of Songs thinking about knowledge, wisdom, the church as a bridegroom, Christ is the bride, bridegroom in the church is the bride. We can use allegory, we can use any approach we want. The poems seem to be vague enough and beautiful enough and powerful enough that they invite as many approaches and interpretations as there are readers and believers. May God be with us if we ever dare to read this stuff, and grant us wisdom as we do.